With us on the line now is Arwinda Kaur. She's an award-winning author and ecological activist who has dedicated her life to helping others. She was a social worker specialising in the area of child welfare for almost 30 years. In her book, Living While Human, she shares the genesis of her moral compass, tracing her own journey of self-discovery through glimpses into her life-changing experiences, encounters and choices. Welcome to the show, Arwinda.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Hannah.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. So tell me about your kind of background and how you came to write this book, the kind of inspiration behind it.
Right. I guess it's been a lifelong journey. As a youngster, I didn't realize when I was traveling that at some point I'd write a book. If I had, I would have definitely kept a diary or a journal. But my early life was that my father came to Canada in 1959, and we came from joining him from India in 1962. So I was 4 years old when I came here, and I was basically did not have any memory of my previous cultural sort of heritage. And then as a teenager, my parents had split up, which was also very unusual in our culture, and that led us to travel to England. And so my family with my father stayed in England for about a year, and I was about 14 or 15 at the time, and I actually had a full-time job as a menial factory job, sewing. So we were earning a living at 14, 15 years of age every day. And from then, we embarked on our 10-month journey to India. And that was the most life-changing experience, probably was the first seeds of changing my perspective, my philosophy, and my understanding of the world and the vast differences in terms of how we live and why we live the way we do, depending on, where we live and the cultural influences of our upbringing.
So why did that trip have such a big impact on you, do you think? What kind of lessons did you learn there?
Yeah, well, I think the first one was definitely realizing that so many of the things that I had in Canada that most of us took for granted were privileges. We considered them to be rights or things that we're entitled to, but really, in many ways, I realized that they were privileges, and that depending on where you live, things that were very basic even were not necessarily a given. For example, the standard of living, even in England, but particularly so in India, this would have been in the early 70s. Obviously, things are different now. But when we traveled there, it was in a real sense, a real culture shock. And the poverty was absolutely overwhelming. I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And it really was eye-opening to realize that this is the same earth that I lived in Canada, but for all intents and purposes, it may as well be on another planet, because people struggled just to live every day. And people just did it, and it wasn't any real complaining about it. You just got on with whatever it was that needed to be done to live your life. And there wasn't a sense of entitlement. There wasn't a sense of blaming other people, scapegoating other people. And so that was one thing I learned, was just in terms of what are the differences between privileges and rights. I've realized that in this part of the world, we think a lot of things are rights when we're fortunate and we're privileged to have them. Probably the other most important thing was, on a personal level, realizing that my self-autonomy and independence was also something that I took for granted. But going to India and seeing how the status of women, particularly at that time, there was a real possibility that my father was going to have to be he was being pressured to marry me and my sister at that time against our will, really. And that would have been just horrifying to realize that, you know, had I been raised there, I probably would have been married at a very young age, and I would have been a domestic servant looking after a husband and his family. I would have probably had multiple children, and my education would have been pretty much non-existent, and I certainly wouldn't have written a book, and I wouldn't have been talking to you about it here. And as I point out in my book, I am child-free by choice, and these probably all had an effect on me to realize that I must be very, very in control of my destiny, because if I'm not, outside forces will certainly make those decisions for me, and that might not be what I want for my life.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Just that realization that we don't choose where we're born. We don't choose the family we're born into. We don't choose the country or the culture that we're born into. We just exist and get what we get, you know? And that becomes really apparent, doesn't it? When you travel and you see people living in such awful conditions and think, my goodness, well, they didn't choose to live here. That's just where they were born.
Exactly. And I certainly also learned, that this whole idea of, you know, recycling, reusing, reducing were already being done over in other countries, especially like in India, because it's certainly just it's an economic reality. They have to do these things. It's the only way that they can survive. They can't afford to waste and just toss things away. So things do get reused, recycled. And also, it's also something that exists in nature. If you look at how we live and how every other species on this planet lives, we are a stark contrast to every other species. And this is where I talk about a blueprint. Nature has a blueprint for how we must live in order to be sustainable and to survive. And so this is not some big secret that we have to come up and figure out for ourselves. We simply need to see, how does nature operate? And is that the reason why it's been so sustainable for billions of years, and only now in the last thousands of years since our appearance and our way of living, we have now brought it to the brink of absolute and total collapse? So it's pretty important for us to look at what nature is doing and learning. The same strategies that nature uses are the ones that we need to use if we hope to survive and prevent this mass extinction.
Yeah. It must be strange if you have groups of people or cultures that are used to living a certain way, a cleaner way of living, both internally and externally, seeing other people destroying the planet, destroying their health, destroying their lives. It must be weird and frustrating when other people have been able to cope so much better and been able to find better ways of doing things.
Well, exactly. And it's not even that we have to create something new. As I say, these things all existed before. In fact, indigenous communities around the globe were still and are still living that way, except that we are also exterminating them just as quickly as we're cutting down the trees. So they are also living within nature's blueprint. And that's why these tribalistic societies have been successful, whether it's in the Amazon or various other places. So we don't need to write new ways to live. We just simply need to observe and open our eyes. And some of the things that we do, humans, and that nature doesn't do, it's all very simple. Nature, everything that's used in nature is created by nature and goes back into nature. In other words, everything is ecologically biodegradable because it comes from nature. They don't outstrip their resources. They don't populate more than what they can sustain. And they don't store warehouses of food. And they don't hunt for any other purpose except to survive. They don't destroy their very environment. They don't create anything that you can refer to as waste. Everything that's waste is actually food for another species. When you think about the water systems, they were absolutely pristine for billions of years. Every bit of earth was pristine and clean. There was no such thing as pollution. And this is all of the billions of species that were living within their own environments, giving birth, you know, eating, eliminating, doing all of the things, building their homes, their trees, their, you know, nests, all of these things. They lived in every single way. They lived in a clean, balanced, sustainable, and really non-violent way. And so we just simply have to say, what is it that nature is doing? And we were doing the same thing, you know, and in indigenous people, they took what they needed for the day, and whatever they made, whether they were weaving baskets or creating tools, all came from the earth. So when we look at how we're living, and I talk about the three, I refer to them as axes of evil. I know that might be a bit extreme, but when I look at corporations are really the head of this, the universe, let's face it, they drive everything. So the corporations are the most powerful, and then they have politicians and the media that are all working in concert together to deflect responsibility away from themselves and onto the individual. And I'm not saying that individuals aren't responsible, because we all must do our part, whether it's, you know, just our own personal lives, choosing to have fewer children or no children. But the corporations, the pressure must be put for them to produce things that are ecologically sustainable. That's where the power is. That's where the billions of, you know, resources are. And they are the ones that are actually causing the most amount of damage, because we're simply using the products that they're producing. So we must put the pressure on corporations and politicians. And unfortunately, too much of the media are simply just, spokespeople for corporations. So we do have a lot of power. We do have the ability to put pressure on them to simply say, we're not going to be buying your products. You need to make them. Why should we spend hours a day sorting out everything and trying to figure out where we put things, what goes in the landfill, what goes in here? They simply need to start creating safer, greener things in the first place. Mm-hmm. And we are also making... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it seems like over the years, over the hundreds of years, you know, life has got more and more complicated. We feel like we want or need more and more stuff, whether it's to do with yes. food, whether it's to do with technology. Yeah. You know, we're all yes. led to believe that the more we have, the better functioning in society will be, or the happier we'll be. So to live such a simple life that you yes. said works really well doesn't seem yes. realistic in today's world, does it?
Well, yes, because we've created this huge global machinery. It's a structure, and it's a machinery, and we've all become little parts in this big machinery and clogged up in it. The other thing we can do is, and it doesn't mean that we need to stop producing things. It's just simply that we need to stop using things that are toxic. You know, toxicity is not, it's poison, and that should not be legal. That's a simple thing. And it's not like there aren't greener alternatives. There are. We simply have to put that onus on them to say, we can no longer put profit over the well-being and the safety. I mean, we say there's no money to do these things, but, you know, when we look at the fact that, you know, war is costing trillions of dollars, you know, if we were to divert all of the money that we are spending on dropping bombs on countries, if we spent that money on making each country healthier economically, people wouldn't have to be fleeing. There's more refugees now than there ever have been in all of history. And this is all from people wanting to flee and look for a better, safer place to live. If we were spending that money on making our places better to live, we wouldn't have the need for war in the first place. So it's not a matter of not having the money. It's a matter of, again, politicians making a decision that is not in the best interest of the people or of the planet. So we, if people are going to have children, they need to start looking at what kind of a life is are their children going to be living in. And we can do things. We can't give up, because that's part of the whole machinery, is to tell us we can't do anything. And yet we know when a movement starts going, it can be like wildfire. And sometimes that means not getting, not going into a violent rage, but certainly being outraged enough that we say this is unacceptable and we want change. And we can do local economies. It's this global production and mass sort of exporting and importing. When you think about all of the labor and resources that go into producing, say, something in Peru and being transported and flown or shipped all the way here to me, is that necessary? You know, we have farms here. We have local resources here. So I think that's the first step. Is each community can start focusing back on how do we create more circular local communities, and our economic system is part of the problem. It's based on a pyramid system where we need exponential growth to increase profit, and that profit goes to the corporations. It doesn't come back into our pockets. Mm-hmm. So, and that's why the population is tied into the economy, because it's based on exponential growth. And I don't know about where you're living, but here it's constant. Every year is not enough infrastructure. There's not enough schools, not enough hospital beds, not enough nurses, not enough teachers. And this is every year. So where is that ever going to be? We have 8 billion on the planet now, and only 25% of the earth is livable. It's the rest of it is water, and that table, water table, is rising. So you don't have to be a mathematician to figure more people, less land. How is that going to work?
Mm. The issue with supermarkets, for example, and fruit and vegetables and them not being shipped halfway across the world, I completely agree with you with that. But it's one of those things that people are used to. You know, if people are thinking, yes, right, we're going to have a nice salad this evening, I want to get some nice tomatoes, and they go to their sure. local greengrocer or whatever, and they say, we haven't got any tomatoes at the moment. They're not in season. You know, we're very lucky in Spain. Sure. There's a lot of fruit and vegetables that are grown where we are, sure. but in certain yeah. parts of the world you won't be able to get yes. tomatoes, which is a basic part of a lot of people's healthy diet. And just the idea that people might not be able to get certain things that they're used to getting all throughout the year, people wouldn't like that, would they?
Right. And this is another point in my book. This is exactly what I talk about, which is what is the difference between a need and a want.
Yeah.
So, for example, if people want to eat, salmon, they feel that is a right, and that that's a need. Not really, because humans are very fortunate. We're one of the few species on this planet that are omnivorous. We can eat and thrive on any source of food, and that's why it was all different depending on where you lived. But we say, no, we want salmon, and we want it 365 days a year, 24/7, on demand. And if that means that there's a shortage of salmon, too bad. And when there is a depletion of salmon, we don't blame ourselves. We blame the seals and say, oh, the seals are eating up. Well, the seals don't have a choice. They have no choice. They live in the water and they eat fish. Yeah. They can't just go to a warehouse or go into a fridge and eat, there isn't any food right now. I'll eat something else. So this is the difference between a need and a want. Yeah. And we're not entitled to everything we want. Our needs are actually the same as all other species on this planet. So maybe that's part of our problem, is we're identifying everything as a need And I'm not saying that you can't have certain things, you know, because just because you want them. But if it simply means that this is going to be something that is actually going to be harmful in some way that to either ourselves or another species, we can make adjustments. We can't have everything on demand. We're simply, you know, that's a luxury. And we are omnivorous. So we have a lot of latitude. We are not going to die. But what's more important is, do we have clean water? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many parts of the world that people are, you know, and even here, people buy bottled water. You know, this, why are we having to do that? The corporations are poisoning the water, and then we turn around and make them profit from it by saying, okay, that's fine. Instead of demanding that they clean it up, we simply just go and buy bottled water, and we don't even question it and say, why do we have to do this? So yes, we are used to a lot of things, but yet at the same time, things that we should be expecting, like, you know, clean air, clean water, viable soil, all the things that we actually need to survive, those things we're not really getting very outraged about. But if we can't have fish today, then we can get pretty irate about that. So we have to look at our priorities, and we have to look at what should we demand, and what can we be flexible about?
Yeah. Well, it's a really great life lesson, I think, that to start looking at all the things that we have in our lives and have access to, food, but other things as well, and be realistic on what we want and what we need. And that need list could be a lot shorter.
I just wanted to let you know that there is a Spanish connection because the artist who did the cover for my book is actually Spanish from the Basque Country. And his last name is Igartua, Paul Igartua. And he's actually quite world famous. So in case anybody did recognize that, his artwork and his name, that is what you will see. And his daughter, Tala Igartua, actually did the foreword for my book. So just wanted to give a shout out to a Spanish artist.
Great. Well, if people want to get a copy of Living While Human, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Arwinda Kaur, who we've been chatting with today. Arwinda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it.